This is Inspired, a production of Interfaith Voices. I'm Amber Khan.
During this time of celebrating Martin Luther King Jr. Day, we're exploring how churches and other American religious institutions have both buttressed and challenged systemic racism. For Yolanda Pierce, this day is an opportunity to examine the civil rights era and the women's movement from the vantage point of women of color. They were often marginalized in the struggle for equality, but then redefined that struggle to cast themselves as central players.
What this particular time of year really represents is a time to examine the civil rights movement more broadly and actually freedom movements more broadly, because we're not just talking about the civil rights movement, we're also talking about Black Power movements, and we could also be talking about contemporary freedom movements. So for me, the opportunity that King's birthday represents is, what does the civil rights movement mean to this country today?
Pierce is the dean of Howard University's School of Divinity, a historically Black university in Washington, D.C. She's also the first woman to serve in that role and a professor of womanist theology. Take a moment to remember the most important women figures of the civil rights movement. Coming up short after Rosa Parks? You're not alone. Pierce says that one of the unfortunate realities of the way we learn about the civil rights movement today is that we've, quote, flattened the experience down to a few key figures. But she says behind the great names in the history books, the lifeblood of the civil rights movement was its women. We invited her to a conversation on how Black women in religion have long strived to shatter the stained glass ceiling.
Whenever I lecture on the civil rights movement, I usually read some names like Septima Clark and Ella Baker and Daisy Lampkin and Edith Sampson and Dorothy Height and Daisy Bates and Ann Moody. And I can tell by the reaction of the audience members that many of them have never heard of these women. And yet all of these women played prominent roles in the civil rights movement. These were women who were organizers. These were women who were going door to door. These were women who were part of the Student Nonviolent Coordinating Committee. They were part of the NAACP. They were part of grassroots movement. These women were doing the heavy lifting and the work around Voting Rights Act, around anti-lynching legislation, around just galvanizing people to participate in the freedom movements. And so when I say their names and I'm greeted with that blank stare, it reminds me that the way that we calibrate how we understand the civil rights movement basically has to do with Rosa Parks and Martin Luther King. But we don't even complicate the figure of a woman like Rosa Parks. Most people think about her as the woman who refused to give up her seat on the bus. Certainly she was a part of that movement, but she was also an anti-rape activist. She was a member of Planned Parenthood. She was someone who, in and of her own self and of her own right, was doing an incredible amount of social activism and community organizing. Unfortunately, the way that we teach American history in this nation flattens out the Black experience. And so as a child, I was taught about slavery, I was taught about King, and then here we are today. And so you have 300 years of history that basically is flattened into the experiences of one or two people. When we talk about Rosa Parks, of course we have to talk about the Montgomery bus boycotts. Of course we have to talk about her participation, other women's participations, the strategy that went into it, the legal challenges that went into it. She didn't just decide one day. This was a planned strategy. But we flatten her story when we don't say that she was on the board of a Planned Parenthood or that she was anti-rape activist, that she deeply cared about intersectionality, which is the word that we would use today, the particular intersecting oppressions of Black women as they were facing both racism and sexism.
What does that mean, intersecting oppressions? I just want to pause there because it's a term I've heard before in academic journals, but it's not something you hear necessarily in conversation.
So if you, again, look at some of the figures of these women that I've named, they were acknowledging the active racism of the historical movement. Of course, they were struggling with the rights to vote and the rights to have access, and they were working very hard against the legacy of Jim and Jane Crow. But also, as women, they faced sexism. They faced a patriarchy and a patriarchal culture. And so these intersecting oppressions means that we have to take seriously both race and gender. And then we also have to throw class in there, because many of these men and women were poor. And so how does poverty color your experience of how you experience racism, but also sexism as well? And they intersect generally in the bodies and the experiences of African-American women.
And the church, I mean, how did the church play a role in all of this?
So it's really a complicated story. The church plays a huge role in this. The church provided sanctuary, literally sometimes physical sanctuary, spaces for civil rights activists to meet, spaces in which the freedom movements were blooming. It provided a vocabulary. It provided literally a soundtrack, the music, the songs. It provided a moral and ethical guidelines of, say, nonviolence and compassion. But not all churches. And so some churches were very, very afraid of a backlash. They were very afraid that by participating in freedom struggles and freedom movements, they would be targeted. Because, of course, they saw what happened to churches that were involved. They were bombed. They faced arson. And so the church's involvement is a complicated story, but certainly it is, and it represents today still the cauldron for freedom movements within the African-American context. And one of the things that we often do in flattening the story is that we talk about the civil rights movement as if it were only a Christian movement, when in fact you have Jewish Americans, you have people who were Hindu, you have people who were Buddhist, who were also participants in civil rights movements. And so it is a religion, and it is a religious movement that was interfaith in that sense.
The icon that we have in our history books today, is there, many have said, because of the leadership and the determination of many, including his wife, Coretta Scott King. Can you speak to her role? I mean, as one of the most visible women, how did she navigate the intersections of multiple oppressions, as you just described?
So we often forget that, unfortunately, after King is killed at such a young age, people think that the movement ended, but it doesn't. And it did not. It continued. And so you have someone like Mrs. King still incredibly active and involved in the civil rights movement and in freedom movement, who continues to march and rally, and whose very presence, not simply because she was the wife and the widow of Dr. King, but because she was a formidable activist in her own right. And we have to tell that as part of the story as well. If we actually are honest about how the civil rights movement unfolds, what we would see is a leadership that was predominantly male. But in terms of the work that was on the ground, in terms of the stuff that needed to get done, from cooking of food to organizing to knocking of doors, we're looking at predominantly women. And that continues to be a reflection of the African-American Christian experience. Even if we look at churches today within the Black church context, we're looking at a leadership that is 80-90% male, even though the membership is 80-90% female.
The leadership today of freedom movements, do they still reflect that discrepancy in terms of gender balance?
You know, I don't think so. And the reason I say that I don't think so is because I think that there were a lot of people who are looking for another Dr. King. But then you have a movement like Black Lives Matter that comes along and says, we are leader full. Right? We are full of leaders, and we don't need one particular figure. And so I look at African-American women in particular who are doing amazing work within their communities and within their context. Now, unfortunately, often we don't label them as a leader. And unfortunately, there are still people who are looking for that one key figure. But I think that on every single level, you have women and men, certainly, who are participating in various struggles. And so who is a leader? Who gets to be a leader, right? Are there leaders because they're doing the work, or are there leaders because we're waiting on someone else to label them as such? And so when I think about the freedom schools that exist today, it's absolutely because of the work of a Fannie Lou Hamer. It's absolutely because of the work of Ella Baker. If I think about the amazing Congress that we have today, it's because someone like Shirley Chisholm, she paved the way, and she did it as someone who came of age during the civil rights movement.
That bringing back and recalling and reexamining and looking at history in the context of the church and in the context of theology, there's something that I've stumbled upon, womanist theology. What is that? And what are some of the essential ideas behind it? And who are the pioneers?
So womanist theology is a branch of academic theology that was founded by African-American women, primarily in the 60s and 70s, and of course, continuing today. These African-American women were working in theology, and much of the theology that they were writing and they were required to read was the outgrowth of white men in theology. Black theology was born primarily as an outgrowth of the civil rights movement, and African-American men, including the iconic James Cone, were writing black theology. But black women weren't seeing themselves in the white theology written by many of the white Christian churches, or even in the black theology that was being authored by African-American men. And so these black women decided to create and to write theological reflections based on their experiences as African-American women. And so womanist theology is a stream of theological thought in which race, class, and gender always intersect with theology, intersect with how we understand the divine and the sacred. And it is not just the product of African-American women, but black women throughout the African diaspora.
I was going to ask you about that, about the broader than African-American women and their voices in this in this scholarship space.
It emerges from a concept coined by Alice Walker, womanist. I think African-American women were probably the first to read and write it. So you have pioneers like Dolores Williams and Katie Cannon, who were adapting this term created by Alice Walker, an African-American woman writer. But it is throughout the African diaspora. And so whether on the continent of Africa, whether throughout the Caribbean, or again, the entirety of the diaspora, you have black women reflecting theologically on whether it is sacred scripture, whether it is the Bible, whether it is their experiences, whether it's on the question of sacraments. But how do black women engage theological work, particularly when we have a longstanding tradition of theological work in which they are not being considered, in which they are invisible?
Mm. The term womanist, it's different from feminist. What makes it different? Why are some more comfortable choosing or embracing one over the other in the African-American community?
So as I was suggesting, that much of Western theology was written largely in part by white men, there emerged feminist theology, and much of feminist theology as it was emerging really looked primarily at white women's experiences. And so when womanist theologians, African-American women, entered into the academy and began to write theology, they used the term womanist to say that we are centering this experience of African-American women, women of the African diaspora. So black women today obviously have a choice. Some still choose the term feminist, some choose the term womanist, but womanist theology itself is birthed because black women did not see themselves represented in the work that was being written and discussed by white women, and then the work that was being written and discussed by white men. One of the things that I see is a shift and a trend, as we all know, with a decline in mainstream and mainline Christianity, and people seeking alternative spaces. And so within the African-American context, there have always been black women who have been parts of other religious tradition, most notably Islam and Judaism. I think that they are also struggling, as black Christian women are, to find a place for their voice, to find a space where they are affirmed. But I see an amazing trend of African-American women looking at traditional African religious practices, be that Santeria, be that Candomblé, be that religions of the Yoruba tradition, that African-American women are looking outside of a traditional organized religion, the big three, Christianity, Judaism, and Islam, looking outside of even organized religion like the Baha'i or Buddhism, and are seeking roots within the African faith context because they're finding in those spaces more opportunities as women to serve as priestess, to serve as mediator, to serve as griot, or to practice in a tradition in which there isn't an hierarchical leadership model. And so we have to watch for how Black women are finding alternative spaces outside of religious contexts, particularly as I think they're seeking the sacred within African religious traditions that have not been widely practiced here in the American context.
That was Yolanda Pierce, Dean of Howard University's School of Divinity and a professor of African American religious history and womanist theology.
You're listening to Inspired. I'm Amber Kahn.